I'm Lakshmi Parthasarathy here on Historic Benefit Street with Matt Barisi, the Executive Director of the Providence Athenaeum, an independent library and cultural center. Matt, thanks for having me here today.
Thanks for having me.
This is great. So I have to tell you, a couple of weeks ago, I was at a friend's wedding in Virginia, and it was hosted at a Virginia Athenaeum. And most of the guests were struggling with how to say Athenaeum. So can you help us set the record straight? How do we say this word?
So it's pronounced Athenaeum. That's the correct way. You can also say Athenaeum.
Okay. So, sorry, is it Athenaeum or Athenaeum?
Well, it's Athenaeum is correct, but okay. A lot of people say Athenaeum.
Well, I'm going to stick with Athenaeum for today. Well, thanks for setting the record straight. Now, what is an Athenaeum?
So an Athenaeum is really a temple to Athena, so that's kind of what it means, just like a museum is a temple to the muses. So this was a... there are 17 of these particular institutions that exist across the United States. They were member libraries. They predate the public library movement. And at the time, they're often referred to either as Athenaeums, or sometimes you'll hear them called mercantile institutes or mechanics institutes. And the reason for that is during the Industrial Revolution, a lot of skilled tradesmen needed a place to house information, and so they invented this institution, and so sometimes they're called mechanics institutes. And in the 19th century, there was a real reverence for the democratic spirit of Athens, and this was new in the Republic because the founders of our country actually did not really think democracy was such a great idea. That's why they didn't make one. They made a republic. But the spirit of the age was such that people appealed to the democratic history of Athens, and so that's where it comes from.
Thanks for sharing that history. You know, walking through here today, I was struck by how beautiful the space is, how peaceful yet overwhelming at the same time because of the history that surrounds us. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of the space?
Sure. So the Athenaeum we opened up in 1838. That's when the building was built. It was designed by William Strickland, who designed the Second Philadelphia Exchange. This is the only example of his architecture that we know of in New England. But the Athenaeum actually dates back further than that to two previous libraries, the Providence Library Company, which was established in 1753, and a previous Providence Athenaeum that resided in the arcade down on Westminster Street. Some of our founders' collection, which we still have in our collection, was collated by Stephen Hopkins, who signed the Declaration of Independence. So we are, our history goes back before the dawn of the Republic.
Wow. Well, let's come back to the present today.
Sure.
Tell me about the mission of the Providence Athenaeum today.
I'm glad you asked, because I brought it with me. It's the Providence Athenaeum seeks to enrich the literary, cultural, and intellectual pursuits of its members and surrounding community through extraordinary collections and innovative programming. We're committed to the stewardship of our historic building, the physical culture of books, and the advancement of the humanities. And the Athenaeum welcomes spirited conversation.
Now, how does that actually play out in your day-to-day work here?
One is through the collections and the exhibits. So we have several strengths in our collections. And so we make sure that we bring our historic collections to the public, and that's really important to us. The second is through the circulating collection. We are one of the larger circulating libraries in Providence, so we want to make sure to engage people that way. And another way is through our distinctive programming, both adult programming and children's programming. We produce more than 150 programs a year here at the Athenaeum. Most are free and open to the public. And in our adult programming, we're focused really on the humanities. So we bring in authors, historians, and thought leaders from across the country to come in and speak to our members.
Sounds like there's a lot of opportunities here for the public to access.
There is, and we have a uniquely public mission among the various Athenaeums that still exist. There's another Athenaeum actually in Boston, which is very wonderful and beautiful, but I think our mission is a little bit more public than theirs. And our Athenaeum really was always sort of had a public-facing mission. And when the library opened in 1838, Francis Wayland, who's one of our founders, said, "We mean here to open a fountain of living water at which the intellectual thirst of the whole community may be slaked." And that's something that we really take to heart here.
Now, I have to admit, I was walking past the Athenaeum a couple of weeks ago, and I thought the building was stunning, but it was slightly intimidating for me, just looking at the gates. And today I've walked in and just seen how wonderful the space is. Almost every desk is taken up here. If I was a student, I would love to be studying in one of these desks. And I hear that it's also free to the public, as you've just shared now. What else are you doing to make this space more inclusive?
Well, it starts with diversifying the programming and the subject areas that we're talking about. So making sure that, we're trying to do humanities-based programming that appeals across the human condition, not necessarily we're just trying to speak to something in the human spirit that's universal to everybody. So I think that's what we're trying to do. But in terms of getting people in the building and making sure that people know that they can come in, because I have had that conversation so many times in Providence, which is they walk past the Athenaeum and it looks very, it can feel a little austere from the outside, maybe even a little tomb-like. It was a really silly thing, but we just put a banner on the gates saying, come on in, everybody come in. And that's really increased our foot traffic tremendously. And we do have relationships with Brown and RISD. And you noted that most every day, every desk here, every seat here is taken up by young people and by people of all ages and demographics.
Great. Well, speaking of young people, I was thinking about my 2-year-old nephew who gets me to read the same book to him about 5 different times. I hear you have some children's programming here. Is this somewhere where I can bring him?
Absolutely. We have story hour every Wednesday. We've got film nights with the kids. We've got special activities that we do. We're having a writer's workshop for kids coming in next in the spring. So we really try to reach out to families that way. It's difficult on the east side because parking is an issue here. It's always an issue. And I have 2 little kids, and it's always difficult. But usually when we do the programs on the weekends, parking isn't really an issue here.
Now, you've been here at the Athenaeum every day. You're a part of the institution. What is one of your most treasured collections or artifacts?
So one of the highlights of our collection is the Description of Egypt. And what this is it's a 25-volume set. I should back up a little bit. When Napoleon invaded France, or invaded Egypt in 1797, he was kicked out, but he left behind this team of surveyors. And they created this magnificent catalog of what they found in Egypt. And it was one of the reasons why Egyptomania became a thing in the 19th century. And the books are just stunning. They're huge. They're half the size of this table. And they documented what they found in the ancient Egypt. They documented the natural history of Egypt, and they documented the modern city. And if you see these etchings that they did, they are almost photorealistic. They're unbelievable. And during this whole enterprise, this was really the life's work of these surveyors who stayed behind. They discovered the Rosetta Stone. So this is a major piece of history that we've got here at the Athenaeum. And I would say it's unique to Rhode Island.
Wow. How do you acquire pieces like this?
So that was acquired by the people who opened the library. They heard about this book and they decided that we needed to have one. So we were we purchased it at auction, and it was from a deposed prince, I think that's how we got it. But nowadays, a lot of things we've acquired is through either legacy bequests, or we've just begun to develop a special collections development fund where we can go out and really start to build the special collections in a meaningful way. One thing that's very special about the Athenaeum in terms of our collections is that our collections have largely been built entirely by the membership over the years. So over 2 centuries, you really get a good handle on what people were reading and interacting with. So it's the collection itself is sort of a historical artifact.
In case you're just tuning in, this is Lakshmi Parthasarathy here with Matt Barisi at the Providence Athenaeum. Matt, I want to go back to some of the programming that you were discussing. You talked about children's programming and programming for young people, but you've also mentioned members. What kind of programming can people expect if they join to be a member of the Providence Athenaeum?
So members, the first thing that they get is they get access to the circulating collection. The second thing that they get is access to some of the... we have book groups here that meet. We have 7 or 8 of them, so they get access to that. And they're usually led by great people with PhDs and expertise in their areas. So it's really a community sort of thing as well. And then they also get access to the program. So we usually call to the members first and say, we've got this great speaker coming. Would you be interested? And, you know, we give that a little time, and then we open it up to the public after that.
And I've also heard that the Providence Athenaeum was the only institution in New England to receive National Endowment for Humanities funding.
I'm not sure. We were the only one to receive a grant from this particular programming, the Sustaining Cultural Heritage Collections Program. I would assume that there are other institutions in New England that received funding from the NEH this year, but from this program, yeah, we were the only one to receive it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Why do you think you were selected for this?
Well, I think the Athenaeum, we put together a good proposal, and we have a great team here at the Athenaeum who really worked hard to put together a great proposal. And I think it's a compelling story because the Athenaeum, it's in need of some tender, loving care. And so the grant is really going to help us do, when people hear that you have funding from the NEA or the NEH, they think all that money is going to artists. But in fact, what it's going to is we're hiring electricians and architects and engineers and conservators to come in here and tell us, hey, what's going on with the wiring in this building? The wiring was installed here when it was installed first. So when electricity was introduced into public buildings, it was introduced into the Athenaeum. And that is great, but that leads to some serious fire hazards now in the 21st century. So we're trying to figure out how to fix that moving forward. So I think it was, you know, a compelling proposal, and I think the Athenaeum is one of Providence and Rhode Island's cultural treasures.
Now, speaking of National Endowment for Humanities and the National Endowment for Arts, should we be concerned about some of the funding cuts going to that should be going to institutions such as yours?
I think absolutely, because the NEA and the NEH, the money spent by these agencies is one of the most efficient uses of federal dollars. It has an ROI of 9-to-1, if that's what we want to talk about, leaving aside the fact that great societies should invest in great culture. The investment that we make in the NEA and the NEH is preposterously small as a leading country. It's kind of insane. And so the whole debate about whether or not we should cut the NEA or the NEH is, to my mind, very short-sighted and ridiculous. And these programs really support not just culture, but as I said, you know, this money is going into the community. This money is going into tradesmen and, you know, very skilled people to come in and conserve this building. So it's really helping the local economy as well.
And you shared that you're trying to reach out to the community about this space by just simply putting up a banner on the front saying, welcome in. What are some other ways that you're reaching out to the community?
So there's a number of ways. I mean, the first thing was, and I should go back to your previous question and just say, everybody should be concerned and everybody should write your senator. And we have a very great congressional delegation here at Rhode Island who supports the arts and humanities. And actually, the NEA and the NEH were founded in part by a Rhode Island senator, Claiborne Pell. And so these agencies have a very special place in the heart of Rhode Island. But moving on to your other question, marketing is a big thing at the Athenaeum. We hadn't done much of it, so I think we invested in that. We overhauled our website. I know everybody says that, but we really tried to do a good rebranding of the whole institution. And then we also we started a public access podcast program. So we produce all these wonderful programs, and we have all these great authors and historians and thinkers coming, but we weren't getting that out to the public beyond Providence. So we started recording them and putting them online and making sure everyone can have access to them free of charge.
Great. And I'm sure you're also reaching out to university students here in Providence.
We are. We have reciprocal privileges, I think, with RISD, and Brown students are always in the building. So, yeah, we're trying to work more with universities as well.
It's great. I mean, if I was a university student, as I mentioned, I would love to be amongst these aisles, just taking in the inspiration.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, students, the funny thing is students kind of don't want the word to get out about the Athenaeum. They're sort of like, don't tell too many people because they like it as a study space.
I'm sure you have to get here pretty early to grab a desk.
You do, yeah, right, almost at 9 o'clock. By 9:30, it's usually taken up.
Well, speaking of inspiration, tell me about some of the notable visitors that have come to this building in the last 200 years. I read about Edgar Allan Poe.
Sure. So the Athenaeum has connections to many famous writers. The two most famous ones probably are Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft. And it's a little odd because both of these figures are the seminal figures in American horror. And the Athenaeum is not particularly known for its horror programming, although American horror really had these two illustrious guests here at the Athenaeum. So Edgar Allan Poe courted his Providence fiancée, Sarah Helen Whitman, here at the Athenaeum. Sarah Whitman was a member of the Athenaeum, and so when Poe was here, they were courting in the stacks, and she said, "I'll marry you, Edgar, but you got to quit drinking." And he said, "No problem," but it was a big problem. And the story goes that they were in the stacks, and she received a letter saying, "I've just seen Edgar. He's passed out, dead drunk in the street." And she said, "That's it. My heart is cleft in twain. We're done." And Poe died, actually, a year after that. But after he died, his legacy came under attack by a man named Rufus Griswold. And Whitman, who was a poet, defended his legacy and wrote a book about it and all this stuff. And in response, Mallarmé sent her a copy of Manet's The Raven, which now hangs in our collection. So we have a connection with Poe that way. And with Lovecraft, who might be a little bit more unfamiliar to your audience, but Lovecraft is probably the most famous author to come out of Providence in general. And he lived a block from the Athenaeum and wrote about the Athenaeum frequently in his correspondence and his fiction. And in Lovecraft's fiction, which is a hugely influential body of work, and really most modern entertainment that you see draws from Lovecraft, including every single superhero you've ever seen. Lovecraft has there's a MacGuffin in his work called the Necronomicon, which is this book bound in human flesh that was hidden at this mystical library, the Orne Library at Miskatonic. And I have every confidence that this library is one of the inspirations for that.
Fascinating. I mean, horror authors, and it's definitely not a horrifying space, just to reassure our listeners. In case you're just tuning in, I'm here with Matt Barisi at the Providence Athenaeum. Matt, I have to also share that as I was walking through the library today, I noticed that every single one of your staff smiled and welcomed me in, which
Great.
Is fantastic.
I'm thrilled to hear that.
Tell me about how you're interacting with people walking into the Athenaeum.
Well, I think there's a balance because I think that the staff wants to be, first of all, all the staff here is fantastic at the Athenaeum, and everybody believes in the mission, which is really important. But secondly, they want to, this is really, we don't have library cards. Our staff know the people by their first names, so we really encourage that. So it's really about relationships with our, you know, I guess, I don't want to use the word customers, our members, you know what I mean? People who come to the Athenaeum. So really, we want to create a warm, welcoming, friendly space for everyone. So we want to make sure you're greeted, make sure if you need help, you get it. But we also want to make sure that we're not bothering you, because a lot of people come here and they just want to be left alone. They want to read the paper. They want to do their work. They want to study. So we want to make sure not to overstep our bounds either.
And I did notice in the basement that you had several newspapers out, magazines for people to peruse. What is your vision for kind of the next couple of years of the Athenaeum and the use of the space?
In terms of the collections or?
Correct, yeah.
So, I mean, the collections is really, and has been for the last 200 years, it's always a moving target. You know, I was looking around, we have a significant holding in DVDs and in audiobooks, which are very highly circulated items. But in 2 years, I can't really imagine that they will be. So we have to always be conscious of deaccessioning items, which is something I'm not a librarian by trade, but when I came here, I realized, you know, the easy thing is getting books here. The hard part is getting the books out once they've stopped circulating, because this media is large, it's difficult to get rid of. There's a question of, should we get rid of it? Some things are historically significant that we should keep and pertain to our special collections. So we have a collections development plan, and we make sure that we stick to it. And we try to deaccession rigorously, but carefully.
Great. Now, I did notice as walking through the aisles, DVDs and CDs that you just mentioned. How are you making it accessible to watch in the space?
Well, in the space, we actually discourage it in the space. Take those things, that's great. You could take them away from here. But when you come to the Athenaeum, what you'll notice is, and what makes us a little different than the public library, there's no computer banks here, there's no... you know, we do have Wi-Fi, we do have plenty of power outlets, and we encourage people to come and study and use their laptops here. But we don't really want to have people watching movies or making a disturbance in the space. So
it's important to note. Now, if there's one thing that everyone should come and see and take in when they come into the Athenaeum, in your opinion, what would that be?
Well, for me, it's The Hours by Edward Malbone. It's a painted ivory. It's in the center of our collection up there, right across. And what this is when the Athenaeum opened, I should have said that I think the total cost for the building in 1836 to 1838 was about $17,000-$18,000 at the time. And that was offered for sale to us for $1,100. And the board said, no thanks, we're, you know, that's a lot of money. But the teenage daughter of the board president said, I'll find the money. And she went all around Providence for a year with a little green sack. And she collected small donations and just managed to get enough to bring that into our collection. And so I think it really says a lot about the Athenaeum and how it survives and how it has survived is through this enormous generosity of a few handful of people, but then also the community support, which is really important for our ongoing enterprises. And I think it's a wonderful piece. It's a beautiful ivory, and I'll show it to you after the interview, but it depicts the past, present, and future. And it's just a beautiful example of painted ivory.
Fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to taking a look at the piece myself, and I hope everyone else takes some time to visit this Athenaeum. You've been hearing from Matt Barisi, the Executive Director of the Providence Athenaeum, an independent library and cultural center. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.